economic meltdown, environmental crisis, seemingly endless warfare. The world is in critical condition. Is that bad news, good news, or a bit of both? Many of the ideas and institutions that define our culture today are breaking down. And that's a good thing, say today's guests, Bruce Lipton and Steve Behrman. In their new book, Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future and a Way to Get There from Here, they write that today's many crises are a necessary part of the natural process of clearing out what no longer serves us to make room for a new way of being that will carry us into the next age. Are they cockeyed optimists, or are they seeing things others are missing? Science has been saying for nearly a century, and we experience, I believe, every time we walk on a beach or in a forest or look in the eyes of a baby, that reality is alive, dynamic, and interconnected. Yet so many of our cultural, societal, political, and economic structures act as if that's not so. For years, actually, I've been asking this question: how can we explain the hypnotic hold of the mechanical worldview in the face of both science and experience? I've occasionally asked that question of guests on the show, and I seldom get a satisfactory answer. Today's guests seem to be asking and answering that same question. Bruce Lipton, Ph.D., is a leading voice in new biology. He bridges science and spirit. A cell biologist by training, he taught at the University of Wisconsin School of Medicine and later performed some pioneering studies at Stanford University. He's the author of The Biology of Belief and his latest, with today's other guest, Steve Behrman, Spontaneous Evolution. Steve Behrman is an author, humorist, and political and cultural commentator who's been writing and performing enlightening comedy as Swami Beyondananda for over 20 years. He's the author of several books prior to his current collaboration with Lipton on Spontaneous Evolution. Welcome, Bruce Lipton.
Thank you so much, Terrence.
And Steve Behrman.
Good to be here.
Every week, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the work and the ideas that we talk about. So first, Bruce, a bit about your path to the work that you're doing today.
Well, Terrence, it started almost, I think, a million years ago in my mind anyway, but when I was very young, I was taken by looking into a microscope the first time and seeing cells moving around, and somehow or other that particular first vision of cells in a microscope ultimately led to my becoming a cellular biologist at the university level and teaching in medical schools. And at that time, I was really pretty much of a conventional biologist, thinking in terms of a body as a mechanical device that was a biochemical machine run by genes, and actually teaching that concept of genetic control of a molecular body. I was teaching that to medical students. But at the same time, I was also doing research in muscular dystrophy, and I was cloning stem cells. And a lot of people think stem cells are relatively new. I was actually cloning stem cells starting about 1967. So for about 40 years ago, I was actually identifying individual stem cells and putting them in culture and following their fate. And what my research led to was something that was so mind-boggling that it actually led to my leaving the university. And the work that I was doing was showing that genetically identical cells put into different environments would have different fates, so that I start with genetically identical stem cells and change the culture environment by changing some of the constituents of their environment, and some cells would form muscle, change environment a little bit differently, and genetically identical cells would form bone, and change it yet again, and another group of genetically identical cells would form fat cells. And there I was, observing that genes did not control the development of the cells. It was the relationship to the environment. And there I was also teaching medical students the concept of genetic determinism, that genes control life. And the research I was doing was saying it was absolutely incorrect, that the genes were actually controlled by the organism's response to the environment. So I left the system, ultimately came back into it at Stanford University School of Medicine, extended the work, and then left the system again, basically because I realized that conventional science was so preoccupied with genes and genetic control that they were not interested in, at that time, how the environment was controlling those genes. The work ultimately led to the Biology of Belief book, which is about 20 or 30 years of research on how does the environment control genes, and it presaged to one of today's leading areas of research in biomedicine called epigenetics. And basically, just to summarize that and get out, is that what I was teaching was something called genetic control, which just literally means control by genes, and what the cells were revealing was epigenetic control, Epi is a prefix that means above. So when I say epidermis, that means the layer above the dermis. So when I say epigenetic control, literally that science is the control above the genes. And this is now the new area of research that reveals an organism's response to the environment changes its genetics. And so how an organism perceives the environment, or what an organism, in the case of humans, for example, believes about environment, those thoughts and that part of the mind actually controls our genetics. And so basically what it says is, I was teaching medical students that we were victims of genes because they were controlling us, and the cells were revealing that we are actually masters of our genes, because if we change our perceptions or beliefs or attitudes about life, we actually change the genetic readout dynamically. So it's a revolution in science, because it's empowering the individual to recognize that your health is under your control.
Okay, very good. That's Bruce Lipton telling me about his path to the work that he's doing today, and that work that we're talking about today is the work that shows up in the book Spontaneous Evolution, co-written with Steve Behrman, in the studio with me today. So, Steve, your path, which I assume is maybe even more circuitous than Bruce's.
It was fairly circuitous. My major was political science, which we all know is an oxymoron. And I went to teach in Washington, D.C. during the late 60s, early 70s, as a very idealistic person. And what I found was that there were some really fabulous ideas out there about how things could be, but the minor detail of putting those ideas into practice and actually living them kind of escaped most people. I remember meeting somebody who was a world-famous expert on communal living, but unfortunately nobody could stand to live with him. So these kind of contradictions, and I realized that I didn't know very much, and I certainly didn't know very much about how we turn the ideal into the real deal. And so my journey for about 30 or 40 years, really, that's 30 years figure, has been exploring various spiritual paths and learning about myself and seeking ways of making these great ideas congruent with actual reality. And having been exposed to holistic medicine over the last period of time, I had this idea of how interesting it would be to write a book about healing the body politic, about looking at the biological or medical metaphor and applying it to our world. And it was when I met Bruce and read The Biology of Belief and listened to him, and we had some great jam sessions, that's when I realized that he was the guy that I was meant to do this book with. And he brought far, far more to it than anything I could imagine, because of his wisdom in relation to our abilities at the cellular level to create a coherent and functional society. And if we can learn to be as smart as ourselves, as we are hoping that we can expand this conversation in Spontaneous Evolution, and then help people see how the beliefs that we've been living by are burned out stars. They really don't apply anymore, and yet we seem to be navigating by them. As you said, Terry, earlier, that, you know, what is it? What keeps this machine going? Why is this monster still breathing? You know, why is Rasputin still alive, you know? And so in the book, we talk about how stories get formulated, and the fact that 95% of who we are and what we think is actually subconscious programming, and that certainly applies to our social interactions. And then we talk about how the very essence of scientific materialism, the beliefs that we navigate by, they've happened to be disproved by science, another minor glitch. And then finally we talk about changing the guard and regrowing the garden, which is looking at how we take this new knowledge, the what so and then the so what, and then apply it to now what. Now what do we do?
It's interesting. Both of you, I asked your path to the work you're doing today, and both of you couldn't resist talking about your book and what it says. We have plenty of time to do that, but it's clear that you guys are eager to do that. But one thing that you left out, and it's kind of indicated by your website, Wake Up Laughing, not exactly what you'd expect of someone who's talking heaviosity here. Part of your path, besides looking at spiritual answers and how to make the ideal real, was humor.
Right, and for the last 20-something years, I've been performing and writing comedy as Swami Beyondananda, the cosmic comic. And the Swami has taught me a lot about this, because humor is a great way to allow new ideas to infiltrate And that goes for the person doing the humor as well. I've learned a lot in having cohabiting with the Swami.
And I'm gonna follow that for another moment here. As someone who's done a lot of improvisation, when you slip into character, the character taps into things that Steve Behrman doesn't know or Terry McNally doesn't know. But if he suddenly decides he's, you know, a long-lost scientist from Slobovia, you've actually found that to be true?
Yes. In fact, I say that the Swami is turban-powered. As soon as he puts the turban on, oh, then we got a whole different set of wisdom coming up.
Very good. Okay, so I like that. If I could say one thing that we don't get quite enough of on my show or on this station or maybe in any, quote, serious media, is humor. So you've sort of answered it, but since you guys come from very different paths, you said, Steve, what you were looking for and how Bruce filled out. Bruce, how did you decide to take on this collaboration?
Well, I was already moving into this area of evolution and got so caught up with cellular biology stuff and my lectures on the biology of belief that I kept putting this vision and understanding of where civilization was in a biological sense on the back burner until Steve and I started getting into discussion. I thought, well, this is a great time to kick this thing off, and I'm so glad we did because it's so appropriate right now in that we talked about this a few years ago, and we had a lot of projections, and they're all manifesting right now, so it's real exciting to see that there's an unveiling of an evolution process, and we're caught right in the middle of it. And it's so exciting because most people are just caught up in, oh, my God, crisis here, crisis there. What are we going to do? The sky's falling. And for the last few years, Steve and I have been crafting this understanding that says, well, this is absolutely a good idea because we are now in a world that's not sustainable, and biologists and scientists have found that we are facing our own extinction by having so messed up the environment that we're compromising ourselves. And so it says very simply is you can't keep doing the same things we've been doing because that's the cause of the problem. And so we have an opportunity to recognize that we're in a transition. So rather than focusing on the crisis part that's coming apart and coming down, what we really want people to understand is this is just a process that allows us to get to a much higher level of evolution, which is immediately in front of us, so that we could really collectively look into the future and transcend this period of upheaval and start to recognize there's a great world in front of us right now.
Okay. Let me start sort of pulling apart and then putting it back together some of the threads that you deal with in the book. And I think we've set up the big undertaking and the context pretty well. One of your key points is you say that there are three perennial questions that any belief system needs to address and that the answers to those questions have changed. Okay, Steve, what are those questions?
The three questions. First of all, why are we here? How did we get here? And now that we're here, how do we make the best of the situation?
And how have those changed?
Well, we started out, I mean, if you look at, you know, recorded history, really, we began with animism. And animism was simply the I am one with everything. And so there wasn't much of a distinction between the spiritual world and the material world. And the indigenous people were able to navigate these two worlds fairly easily. And that kind of paces the being in the garden, being a part of the garden. And had we stayed at that point, we would be a little more than human animals in a cosmic petting zoo. But we ventured out of that to explore, and I think that another way to explain evolution is collective learning of awareness, learning about itself. And so we then began to see, as a young child begins to see the world, we began to see that there are many forces. We began to recognize that there's the me and there's the not me. And in the not me, we began to assign powers to these various gods. So we had polytheism. Then we had the monotheistic view, which is that there is only one God and one power. And we had the institutionalized version of monotheism through the institutionalized version of Christianity, which was very powerful throughout the Middle Ages and so on. And at some point,
To jump in, you only said the institutionalized version of Christianity, not Islam, not Judaism?
Well, what I'm saying is that the most powerful form of that, which has impacted Western society, I mean, in a certain sense, Judaism had monotheism long before, you know, while Greece was worshiping many gods. But in terms of, to really compress this conversation.
Okay, I just wondered.
We're not slighting anybody.
If you're talking about the Western worldview.
Western worldview, and that's really that's what gave birth to scientific materialism, because of the, you know, Christianity, the institutionalized version of the church, and its infallibility. The first little chip to fall was another minor detail, Copernicus recognizing that the Earth actually revolved around the Sun. And it took over 100 years for that belief to be integrated, throughout the thinking world and so on. So we saw that that as soon as the church lost its infallibility in that regard, then we began to see the rise of scientific materialism, which is the current dominant paradigm. And that essentially, as you were referring to earlier, Terry, that is where it's the material world that matters. You know, you look at Newton and Descartes and all of that, and all of those people, what they really were saying is that the universe is a machine. And so in the book, we actually talk about, in the first part of the book, the section called What If Everything You Know Is Wrong? During that part of the book, we talk about how these belief systems have evolved as new understandings and new knowledge have come about. So right now, we are at the threshold of a really new understanding, which we in the book call holism. And that is that, you know, what we call science and what we call spirit are really part of the same thing. And so what we have are institutions based on scientific materialism, based on these beliefs that have been actually disproved by
right.
science.
I think
Bruce could
interesting,
tell you more about that.
If I can jump in, Steve, is that I've often thought, how come? I mean, in some ways it's mind-boggling that while it took 100 years for the culture to accommodate Copernicus and quite a while to accommodate Galileo, you would think that would happen quicker now. But it isn't. In other words, the discoveries in science that still do not seem to dictate our worldview models go back to the very start of the 20th century.
Yeah, Einstein's theory in 1905. So we're 100 years past that. But then we're also 2,000 years past Jesus, who said, love thy neighbor as thyself. So it takes certain things longer to integrate. At this point, because of the crisis that we're in, because none of our institutions are working, we have what we call institutionalized insanity, more and more people are looking at, well, okay, if we have this insanity, then how do we go sane? And what is sane? And what is, interesting, sanity has the same root as health, sanus, sanitation.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So it's not that sanity is not some arbitrary, you know, we all vote for, you know, the majority of us believe that this is sane. There really is something that's essential, that's beyond our culture, epicultural, perhaps, that is health, sanity, and coherence. And now we're beginning to recognize in this process of going sane that so many people seem to have embarked on right now, we're beginning to recognize that there is an entirely new structure and an entirely new order that's predicted by science.
I'm going to make one quick observation that I've made before on this show that I don't even need a response for, but it's that that moment when we went from polytheism, which was a god for the weather and a god for the harvest and a god for, you know, et cetera, to monotheism, that it strikes me that the revelation of one was an accurate and helpful revelation. The misinterpretation of that revelation as meaning my one versus your one is we've been paying the price for this, at least 4,000 years. Let me ask Bruce Lipton to take this one. I'm going to go to the next piece of your construction of this whole idea, which is these myth perceptions, unexamined pillars that support modern thought. This is picking up where Steve left off. And what are some of these in science that actually have been proven wrong and just the public hasn't been let in on that yet?
Well, Terrence, the interesting thing about these misperceptions, just to add to Steve's a little bit, is that what we have to say is that the answers to those questions that we talked about, the perennial questions, when the general population accepts some particular answer from some group or some entity and say these are the answers we accept, that we also have to recognize that when we need any other truth about our world, we go to that source. So, for example, in the days when the church was running the show, even if you want to find out about health or what's going on in the future of the world, you always went to the priest or the church to get the answers.
Or previous to that, the medicine man.
The medicine man, which would back in animism. So there's always, that was the important point, is that we seek our truth from whoever provides these answers. And when science took over, which was after Charles Darwin, then we started to find, oh, you want a truth. Well, you don't go to the church anymore. Now you go to the science people. And it becomes very interesting to recognize that then the flavor of the answers is actually what flavors the culture and character. So when the answers change, then that's when the civilization changes, because we change the character of how we run our lives. So, for example, the current vision in scientific materialism is basically, number one, our belief in matter is primary. And so that's a Newtonian belief, that the universe is a physical, mechanical machine. It takes our attention away from the invisible realm, which was what the church was talking about as primary. They were talking about spiritual realm as primary. Science comes in and said, no, the material realm is primary. So as a collective group, we started to more or less as a culture focus on material acquisition as a representation of how well we're doing in our lives, because the more matter you have, that means that you're more effective in this world. So we get more Humvees, we the earth and the environment apart as our culture is seeking more matter, and that, you know, he who dies with the most toys wins kind of concept. And this vision has changed, as we talked about, over 100 years ago, because quantum physics came in and said, you know that thing you ignored, that invisible stuff? Well, according to quantum physics, the invisible realm is the primary shaper of the physical realm. So what we really have to start to recognize is, well, we've been focusing on matter. Now we have to focus on the invisible realm. Well, what's that? Well, those are in our personal lives, our thoughts, which become the shaper of our biology and our emotions and our attitudes. And as we change those and start recognizing that's where our richness of life is coming from and let go of the material realm, then we're going to change our preoccupation with destroying the earth. So
okay, let me cut in for a second, Bruce.
Yeah.
So the first one of these myth perceptions is Newtonian physics.
Yes.
and that sort of thing. Let me challenge one thing, though.
Yes.
What I hear in what you were just saying was kind of a duality there. That,
yes,
that they were paying attention to matter, and we got to pay attention to the invisible. I mean, holism, it seems to me, is not paying attention to one or the other. It's realizing that they are, in fact, the same.
Exactly. That's what the conclusion ultimately comes to, is because if we do look over history, and Steve started to talk to us about the different civilizations that have come and gone, the primary differences between them are whether they are emphasizing the spiritual realm as being primary or the material realm. And animism, as Steve started out, said, no, they recognize both were in the same thing, and you deal with both of them. We're coming back to that. After having taken civilization off to the spiritual realm under the church and then into the material realm under the sciences, science and spirituality are coming back to a midpoint to
Good.
Recognize that they're both very critical. And what we've left out of our current civilization, of course, is the spiritual element, because for the last 150 years, the science has not really emphasized that. So we're bringing that back in. So if there was a little emphasis on that, Terrence, it was only because that's the piece that's missing in today's world that says, wait, there's more to us than this physical plane.
Very good. Let me cut in and go to this, which is, let's go to point two,
yes,
which is genetic control of life.
Right, and that's
Steve referred to that a little bit, I think, earlier. But what is that belief, and what's the new belief?
Okay, old belief, genes control who we are. We didn't select the genes. We can't change the genes. And consequently, then our lives are seemingly out of our control, because the genes are predetermining our fate. And so we buy into the belief of that kind of science that, well, I'm a victim, and I can't get out of this, so I need a rescuer. So as victims, we turn over our health care to other people, when it turns out the new biology reveals that, no, our thoughts and our beliefs and the way we interact with the environment, they control our genetics.
Okay, so let me ask a question prior to that one, which is that I think one of the common misperceptions that most people have is that your genetic blueprint is that there is a blueprint that you were born with or you were conceived with, and that blueprint basically is going to play out in your life. And what you're saying is, you are born with a genetic structure, but it's not a blueprint. It's not a done deal. again, not this either or, that in fact it isn't just, because I want to make sure that people hear this right, you aren't saying just our thoughts and our feelings influence these things, but our environment, and that our thoughts and our feelings are part of our environment. But that's really what it is, right? That it isn't just like you're a clock that's set out and unwind for the rest of your life doing exactly what your genes told you were going to do, that the interactions with a toxic physical environment will also influence your genes. But what you're pointing out is that it is this interaction that's going to play out in our lives, and that gives us some power.
Oh, absolutely, because if you look at the way, if I give you the story that we've been living by, then I say, you have no power, just get a good health insurance policy. And what we're talking about is, you do have a power, you are a participant in this reality. And so is everybody else involved with this participation. So it takes us from complete victim on the belief that is our current belief, and puts us into the part that we are active and participating in the unfoldment of our own genetics, our own health, and the world that we live in. So it says, okay, stop standing back and waiting for things to happen, because we can take a step forward and start to manifest rather than to be passive recipients.
You're saying that from a position of science, not from a position of belief.
Absolutely.
Okay. And what's funny is, this whole idea of what's true and false, they weren't necessarily false when they were conceived. They were correct as far as they went. The problem is that we have run our societies as if they were the whole truth and nothing but the truth. One of those was Newtonian physics. Another was that genes control your life and you have nothing to do about it. Two others are survival of the fittest and the notion of random evolution. Bruce, you want to take that one?
Yeah, just very quickly, is that those are the premises of Darwinian evolution, how we got here and how our future apparently unfolds. So that when that became a scientific belief, when Darwin's premise that random mutations got life going and provided for the biosphere, and that life is based on a struggle for survival with competition to see who is going to be the fittest, those beliefs, from a scientific perspective, were then put into our civilization. So look at our world as a consequence. We live in a world based on total competition and struggle. And we live in that world because that's our belief scientifically, that's the way the world really is. The question is the world that way, or did our beliefs create that? And so now when we look at the nature of evolution, number one, we find that evolution is not driven by competition. In fact, that's destructive. That evolution, when we look at the nature of the entangled community called the biosphere, is actually a representation of cooperation and community. So that our evolution says, as long as we've been competing, we've been actually anti-evolutionary. That we need to come together, recognize our unity, that what's evolving is not the individual human. Humans evolved over a million years ago. That evolution is done. The evolution that is upon us right now is the evolution where we recognize that the living organism, the superorganism, is called humanity. And that we are all cells in the same body of one living thing. And unfortunately, the way we're living on our world today is mimicking the biggest health issues in the world in this regard, that the biggest health crisis problems are something called autoimmune disease. And autoimmune diseases like arthritis and Alzheimer's and cancer are actually autoimmune disease. Latin means self-destruction. And so
let me ask you again.
Issue in the body is self-destruction. We look at the world and realize the cells making up humanity are killing each other as well. So we have like an autoimmune disease affecting our evolution until we understand we're all part of one organism and cooperation is the key.
You said the diseases that are troubling the most are autoimmune diseases. I assume if I'm living in certain parts of the world, diarrhea is actually the biggest problem, or malaria. And so I think what you're saying is that those problems bothering us most in advanced countries are autoimmune diseases.
Well, no, I would also have to say there as well, for a simple reason, is that the fundamental underlying issue almost of all illnesses today is a thing called stress. That is the primary drive force. In fact, 90% of doctor visits are specifically stress-related. And why then the stress has to come into this, the diarrhea and those other things like that, is that one of the things that we talk about in the book is that when stress hormones are released into your body, the same hormones that get you ready for fight and flight and protect your life actually shut off the immune system. As a matter of fact, medical doctors use stress hormones in therapy when they transplant an organ or tissue into a recipient. They give them stress hormones to inhibit the immune system.
Right, and let me just jump in. If you think about it, folks, and we've talked about this on the show before, is that when you were, in the old days, faced by a tiger or something, you didn't need immunity right then. You didn't need digestion. You didn't need much intellectual capacity. What you needed was speed and force. It was a survival mechanism that it would turn off certain things and turn on others. The problem is that now those stressors are often symbolic and often constant in modern society.
That's the problem, yes.
Let me jump finally to the last one, which is this notion of random evolution.
That's a very critical one, because when you say, well, why are we here? If you start with, well, it's random mutations, then your answer would be, well, there's no reason for us to be here. It was just an accident. It was sort of like a genetic crapshoot, and that's how you got here. It was just an accident. Well, the problem with that belief is then it disconnects us from the biosphere and all the other organisms and the planet. It just says we were sort of just luckily ended up here in this environment. And it turns out, no, that the fundamental nature of evolution is every new organism that evolved to come into the biosphere came in a process of bringing harmony and balance to the biosphere. So when you introduce one organism, it tries to bring in balance, but then after a period of time, it goes into overbalance. So then a new organism is introduced to bring it all back to balance. And so evolution has been an effort to bring harmony and balance into the environment. Well, then you look at the world that we came into and say, no, we just got here by accident, and we can use this environment in any way we want. It's irrelevant in that sense. And so by seeing our disconnect from the environment, we end up destroying the environment. And that's where our threat for our own extinction comes in, because we, through our own behavior, are upsetting the harmony and balance of the ecosphere, and that threatens our own existence.
Okay, so the point there is that the randomness, if you believe randomness, then all bets are off.
Absolutely.
But what you're saying is that actually it's not, that evolution is not about me or a dog or a mosquito, that it's about ecosystems and larger ecosystems, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay, so that can then give you a sense of being part of something, of having some purposive role in the evolution and survival of larger things than yourself, and that changes from all bets are off to let's figure out how to do this well together.
And it's interesting because, as Steve said, we started this whole cycle of civilizations with animism, like the Native Americans. And we have to actually return to that kind of awareness which they were living under, where they were talking about they were there to tend the garden. And our absence of tending the garden has led to the destruction of the garden. And now there's a necessity to return back to that level. So our belief system, which allows us to pollute and say, oh, well, don't worry about it, it'll go away, turns out that scientific understanding is now, has us confronting our own extinction, because it turns out, my God, no, we are part of an intricate and delicate network, a web of life.
Very good. Okay. That was the voice of Bruce Lipton. I also have in the studio with me Steve Behrman, and they are the authors of Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future, and A Way to Get There From Here. Let me turn to Steve on this question, and we're going to jump from the scientific premises that we're dealing with to one of your conclusions, which is that the crises and breakdowns that we're facing are in some ways a good thing, that they're going to allow the rise of new and better systems. That may not be such good news to a lot of people who are being hurt in the process. Speak to them.
Well, you know, interestingly, you mentioned the malaria and the diarrhea and so on. And those kinds of illnesses are a function of this dominator belief system, the survival of the fittest, as opposed to what we talk about, the thrival of the fittingest, that when you disperse resources in such a way where everybody benefits and you build a commonwealth, then what happens is that you spend less time, energy, money, attention on fixing things that could have been prevented. So we spend less energy than protecting ourselves from one another. And when we allow every individual to thrive and every local garden to thrive, in that sense, then we eliminate these diseases, because we allow these people to, you know, rather than the monocultures which we see in so many of the third world countries, you know, we encourage a growing your own food, local sustainability, local energy, local autonomy. All of a sudden, every group makes a contribution. Now, interestingly, and Bruce could go into great detail about this, we have underneath our skins a 50 trillion cell, highly functional community with technology that far outstrips anything that we've come up with our human minds. This system is so impeccable when we're healthy and so harmonious. We have full employment, universal health care, no cell left behind, and the organs are cooperating with one another so that the whole system can thrive. You never hear about the liver invading the pancreas, demanding the islets of Langerhans. It just doesn't happen. So we have a highly functional system where it's recognized that every organ has its job. Well, in a similar way, we can begin to imagine, and we could talk more about how we can actually put these ideas into practice in our lives and community and world, but we can begin by imagining. Awareness is really the first step, and every phase of evolution involves expanding awareness and expanding connection.
Now, wait, you're saying that not just conscious evolution, but you're saying every phase of evolution, even evolution that appears to us to be simply physical, arises through awareness and connection?
Well, of course. When single-cell organisms decided they didn't want to be single anymore, what they did was they combined in community, right? They became a community. And in the process of combining as a community, they enhanced the awareness of each cell. Each cell had access to the information that was being gathered and used by other cells. And then we've had specialization of cells. And some cells that would never see the light of day but would get the signal about what was happening out there in the world. So now we are a community of 50 trillion cells working in concert, working together. And our cells may not be aware the way you and I are aware, but that gives us an advantage at this next phase of evolution where we now can consciously participate in this process of weaving a web of mass construction.
Instead of mass destruction.
Yeah.
Yes. Okay, so that was Steve Behrman. This is interesting what you're saying. So this metaphor between the cells and an organism of cells is very much a part of the whole vision that's embedded in this book, right?
Yeah.
I mean, on that just a little
okay.
more.
Okay, well, if you imagine that we are, as Bruce said earlier, that human evolution, we don't need to grow another arm. We don't need to grow a bigger brain. What we're growing is in awareness and in connection via community. So if that's so, then what are the implications of that? How do I live my life knowing this new information, not survival of the fittest, but cooperation is really how nature works. Environments evolving as a system. How do we participate in the system? How do we take ourselves not just off the endangered species list, but off the endangering species
right.
list?
Right, I was waiting for that one.
Yeah, because we're definitely on that. And so what do we do in terms of how we live our lives as individuals? And then how we relate to other people? We begin to recognize that politically, we've been divided, or we've divided ourselves into these groups, you know, and it really would be as if the liver said, "I'm not talking to the heart. The hell with them," you know. And when we begin to recognize that every nationality, every cluster of human cells is an organ. It's an organ in this body of humanity. So the organizations are really organs. Well, what would it be like if our organization, like the organization of money, or the organization of healthcare, or the organization of a justice system, what would it be like if those actually worked in concert with one another rather than in competition? And these are really important questions to begin to ask as the first step of awareness. As we lift ourselves outside the matrix of these invisible beliefs that we mistake for reality.
Very good. That was Steve Behrman. I'm speaking with him and Bruce Lipton about their book, Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future. Let me say that sometimes I like to take, or I often look at problems with three big questions, which is, once I establish something is broken, it's okay. So something's broken, the healthcare system's broken, the education system's broken, etc. Then the question is, how is it broken? What's the evidence? And I think we're going to dispense with that because There's no question. The economy's broken, the healthcare system's broken, the peace system is broken, the pollution system's broken, et cetera, et cetera. The equity system is really broken. Okay, how did it get broken? What is the history? What are the causes? We've dealt so far with this on a fairly big level. In other words, on the level of belief systems and worldviews. We could go into each one of those and see how, deriving from those belief systems and those worldviews, we could trace the history, but we will leave that aside for now. The third question, which we have about 10 minutes left, is how do we fix it? What are the solutions? And in this case, you've begun to talk in that direction, Steve, just now, and I heard cooperation, awareness, connection, local, those sorts of things. If I'm a listener and I buy what I've heard, and as I said, there's that one little hook here that's troubling, which is that the good news also has bad news for a lot of people. A lot of people are getting hurt by the crises we face. But let's go from there. What would a listener want to learn, want to know, want to do to begin to participate in this spontaneous evolution? And I'll tell you what, Steve, let me jump to Bruce. And Bruce, try to keep this one brief because our time is short now. So you know a lot more than I'm going to allow you to say right now. But talk a bit about this in terms of that cellular metaphor.
Well, basically what we have to start recognizing is that our belief systems are controlled by our mind, and we have two aspects of our mind that become very critical, and this is discussed in the book. And it says that we have a conscious mind, which is the creative mind, the one that has our wishes and desires. And we have a subconscious mind, which is a habit mind with programs downloaded in it. We have a general belief that we're running our lives with our creative mind. So a lot of people out there, yeah, okay, we're facing crisis. Let's go out there and create these answers and solutions. But it turns out that 95% of our life comes from the habit mind. And that's been programmed primarily by our culture and by other people. So this is the hard part, is that we have a lot of people in a situation that says, okay, let's get to work and make the change. And that, unfortunately, is the small part of our mind's control, the 5% of that creativity.
So you're saying, just to jump in, even with the best of intentions, that's missing 95% of where the action is.
Absolutely. So that's why we always find, why are we struggling so hard to get to where we want to go? And the answer is because we're operating from these invisible beliefs that were programmed into us before we were six about how life works and how, you know, like if you're a boy, you watch your father, you see the stresses and struggles that he goes through in your first 6 years of your life. That becomes a behavioral program that's in your subconscious mind. Then you're older and you say, oh, let's have a life that's wonderful and joyous and happy. And then I tell you, yeah, but only 5% of your life is coming from that part of your mind. 95% is going to play the behaviors downloaded from your parents. And I just want people to understand they're invisible. That's why I say in my lectures, you have a friend, a very close friend, and you know your friend's parent, and then one day you just casually suggest to your friend, you know, Bill, you're just like your dad. And that's when you back away from Bill, because he's the first guy to vent. I say, how can you compare me to my dad? And this is instructive and profound, because what it says is everybody else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. It's only Bill who doesn't see it. So what's the point? We have programs, they operate invisibly, we don't even see them, and they undermine us. And until we become aware of that, we look like we're victims to the world. I mean, I go out there and say, I want peace and love and harmony and health, and look, we don't get it, so therefore the universe is against us. And then it turns out from the new biology, we were undermining ourselves with the acquired beliefs of that culture, and we have to rewrite those beliefs to re-empower ourselves.
Okay, now, either one of you can take this, and as you begin to answer, just say which one you are. Where I see a little gap there is, okay, these 95% are subconscious, they're habitual, they're patterned. Are we able to change those from the 5% that's creative and thinks it's in charge, or is there something more mysterious going on? In other words, if I'm going to take away from this conversation something that says, I came in knowing there were lots of crises outside. Now I find out that 95% of what I do is out of my control. I could be even worse off. Where's the good news?
Well, the good news is if we become aware of this, then we could do something about it. I mean, being forewarned is being forearmed.
What?
I mean, if we look at our lives as, oh, I'm a victim and all these things are happening.
I got that. What do I do about that 95% that's habitual, Steve?
Okay, well, first of all, once you recognize how much of our reality is really programs, then you can begin to forgive yourself, you can begin to forgive other people, and you begin to recognize that the one thing that we have in common is that we're all programmed. And so once you have that recognition, that's only a first step of stepping outside the matrix of controlled beliefs. And so, wait a minute, I've been told that that person over there is my enemy. They've been programmed like I've been programmed, only with a different program, so they have a different reality, therefore we disagree. So the first step in all of that is recognizing that we are all programmed, and that this so-called reality, what we really have in common, is not up in our heads, it's in our hearts. And if we had longer time for that conversation, there's a lot of science that shows that we have, we can actually walk into a room and actually begin to entrain with one another.
Entrain means to begin to have similar heartbeat, similar
a tuning fork.
We begin to harmonize.
Yeah. We begin to harmonize. And so when you take people out of the beliefs that they're stuck in their heads with, and you begin to create situations where people can communicate and listen in a respectful way, an interesting thing happens. You begin to focus on what we have in common as a humanity, and we begin the process of thinking like a species instead of thinking like individuals. A fit individual, if the species doesn't survive, you're not going to be able to drive that Mercedes very far. The other thing that I want to add, and I know Bruce would add this too, very, very important in terms of the hope or fears that we might have about what's coming and where we are with this. We are in a very similar situation to the caterpillar transforming into the butterfly. When you read the news, it's all about the caterpillar. The caterpillar, which cannot be fixed. And go fix the caterpillar so the butterfly doesn't happen. What's really happening, and the people who are reading this book and finding power in reading this book, this is the butterfly, the imaginal cells of this new butterfly organism beginning to communicate with one another and allowing this new organism, this new structure, to emerge from that as the caterpillar collapses. So it's a matter of focus. Do we focus on the Titanic or the party boat that's happening right over here? And that's really what our choice is as we begin to...
Well, I'm gonna break in again because it's so funny how the premise of all of this is holism.
Yeah.
And yet I think out of habit, we end up dualism. I don't believe it's a choice between do we focus on this or that. In other words, I'm not gonna be satisfied to ignore the hunger and the inequity that's going on and focus on the party.
No, I wouldn't ignore that. I certainly wouldn't ignore that. That's not what we're talking about. We're simply talking about the new structure that's being built. Only the new structure can actually create a situation where that hunger
can be solved.
We can't solve it at the level that we've created the problem.
So what you're saying is not focus on where the goodies are. You're saying focus on where the possibility is, the possibility of evolution, the possibility of transformation, the possibility of solution.
Yeah, in the dueling dualities, there isn't a possibility.
Right.
That's where the possibility isn't.
Right.
So I'm not saying, I'm sure it's not saying the same thing. You know, we're not saying that we are to ignore all of these problems in the world. We're simply putting our attention on what we are building instead.
Okay, I'll tell you what, we are almost at the end. I will give you, Bruce, since Steve just spoke, a 30-second closing statement, and then I got to close it.
No, it's basically that there's a lot of hope in our future because, as we emphasize, that the breakdown is only a necessary part to build a foundation that is more sustainable. That, yes, people will be involved and there are going to be people that are going to have problems with it and there are going to be people that are going to have great success with this. And yet, what the last thing that you brought up was, it's still a community. Like when you look in your body, there are no cells that are going hungry. Every cell has to get fed before the body even calls itself in harmony at all. So basically, what it says is when we treat all humans as cells in one body and that everybody gets the basics of life, then from that point on, we have a foundation to build the most exciting future in the world, not like it is today where we can write off populations because they don't fit into our economic textbook or something like that. Every cell counts. Every human counts.
Okay. Again, the websites are BruceLipton.com, that's one word, BruceLipton.com, and WakeUpLaughing.com, that's Steve's. The book is Spontaneous Evolution, Our Positive Future, and a Way to Get There from Here. You can listen to this week's conversation and many others at any time during the week by linking to our podcast. You can sign up to have it delivered to you weekly. For podcasts, articles, transcripts of interviews, to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, email me at T.E. McNally, T.E. McNally at mac.com, to learn how to get my weekly announcement of that list and a lot of other things. My website is terrymcnally.net. Thank you, Bruce Lipton, Steve Behrman. Keep up the good work.
Thanks, Jared.
Okay.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.